sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the second and final part of a speech given by Ellen Brown at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California, on May 16, 2010. She speaks about the financial 9/11. Ellen Brown developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. In her latest book, The Web of Debt, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we the people can get it back. Brown developed an interest in the developing world and its problems while living abroad for 11 years in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. She returned to practicing law when she was asked to join the legal team of a popular Tijuana healer with an innovative cancer therapy, who was targeted by the chemotherapy industry in the 1990s. That experience produced her book Forbidden Medicine, which traces the suppression of natural health treatments to the same corrupting influences that have captured the money system. So here she is, Ellen Brown.
Now, Gordon Brown himself has often called for a new global financial order. In 2007, he called for a new world order reforming the UN, the World Bank, the IMF, and the G7. At the G20 conference in October of 2008, he called for a new Bretton Woods creating global governance. And in 2009, sometimes it takes a crisis for people to agree that what is obvious and should have been done years ago can no longer be postponed. It's shock therapy. We must create a new international financial architecture for the global age. The threats and challenges we face today are the difficult birth pangs of a new global order. Well, it's just such odd language. You would never talk about a new global order. Like, don't worry, it's just the new global order. It's language you would not use unless you had routinely gone to meetings, secret meetings or private meetings, where people are talking about the new world order and that this is what we're tending toward and this is what we're trying to do here. And we have the famous Rockefeller statements that are quite similar. In 1994, he said, David Rockefeller said, "We are on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the new world order." And then in his memoirs in 2002, he said, "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it." I mean, they actually believe in this stuff, that the New World Order is a good idea. So we can trace that back farther to Carol Quigley in the 60s wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope. He was an insider who was groomed by the international bankers. And he, too, actually thought this was a good idea, the whole New World Order thing. He was actually Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown University. But the one thing he disagreed with the international bankers, as he called them, was that they wanted to keep it all secret, and he thought that, you know, he should write about it. So he wrote this 900-page tome that was immediately suppressed. It was very difficult to get until somebody found a pirated copy and republished it. Now you can get it. But he said in this book, "The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole." He went on, "Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans." So that's what we have going on now, where he said somewhere else in the book that what they would do would be to create the money privately and make it look like it was created by governments. So governments would get the blame when everything goes wrong. But in fact, all the money is created by these private central banks, or even when they're publicly owned, they're still separate, like the Bank of England, which is independent. It creates the money and lends it to the government and to individuals and corporations. So the source of the money is this private banking cartel. He went on, the apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Now, the Bank for International Settlements is very controversial. It was in the 1940s, the U.S. government and John Maynard Keynes tried to get it shut down because they had been accused of laundering the Nazi gold during World War II. They didn't get it shut down. I have to be careful what I say because my daughter lives two blocks from the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, and she's actually trying to work with them to get like alternative funding for, she works for a UN NGO, and she goes, Mom, you got to be careful what you say. So, you know, they're good people that work in all these institutions. And even Gordon Brown, I heard him give a speech recently. I mean, I heard it on the internet. And it was very reasonable. He was talking labor and stuff. I mean, it was very good, and he was saying all the right things. So I don't want to say that anybody's like inherently evil or a huge crook or whatever, but there is another system going on here, an attempt to create the money system of the world privately. And it's just not a good idea. It's not working out, and we need to oppose that, and we can oppose it. What we need to do is set up our own model so that we're not dependent on the private banks. If we set up publicly owned banks that work the same way they do, their banks work, then we don't need to bail them out. We can just let them die by attrition. We can let them go bankrupt and nationalize them and turn them into a public utility, which is what credit should be. Credit is the credit of the people, the credit of the community. It should be a public utility. So today, the Bank for International Settlements is indeed, as Quigley foresaw, the capstone of the international banking pyramid. It has 55 member nations, and it sets the rules for all these banks. We saw the power of the Bank for International Settlements to make or break economies and banks in the 1988 when the Japanese banks were the world's largest creditors. The Japanese economy was booming and the banks were huge and everybody owed money to Japan. And then the Bank for International Settlements raised the capital requirement by 2%, from 6% to 8%. Didn't look like that big of a deal, but it was enough to wipe out the Japanese banks. They were crippled and they've never recovered. They were actually nationalized, although they didn't use that word, but that was the only way they could save the banks because they just didn't have the capital to make the loans. The way the capital requirement works is you're supposed to have $8 of capital for $100 in loans. So the way our banks got around that was if you have your $8 in capital, they would take the $100 in loans, bundle them up in mortgage-backed securities, and sell them off to investors. And then they could make another $100 in loans, and then another $100 in loans based on that same $8. But what happened was, you know, then they got into the whole subprime. Since they were selling off these loans, they didn't care whether they were good loans or not, because they weren't going to be responsible for them. The sucker investors were going to take them. So then they started selling to anybody in sight just to keep this whole bubble thing going. And that's when the Wall Street banks got out of hand. So this is the securitization process that we got into. But that first change in capital requirements was called Basel I. Well, then they came out with Basel II. This is the one that killed our banks. Basel II was called value at risk accounting. So they changed accounting standards. The two Bear Stearns hedge funds were bombed collapsed in the summer of 2007, and that's when we knew we had a problem. And markets got very shaky, and everybody started worrying about these collateralized debt obligations. But actually, in October of 2007, our stock market was the highest ever. And then in November, that's when it collapsed. Well, the reason it collapsed was that was when our Financial Accounting Stability Services Board, the board that sets the accounting standards for the U.S., adopted this Basel II value at risk accounting, or it was called mark-to-market accounting. So that meant that there was a sudden rule change. So all the banks that had all these loans outstanding based on capital that they had valued according to whatever they wanted. Nobody really knew what these derivatives, I know I'm getting into things that I haven't explained, but you have to read my book to understand all these details. But the point is, they changed accounting standards in the middle of the game. So even though it was actually probably a good thing, the mark-to-market rule was probably a good idea. You want banks to be valuing their capital according to what the market will fetch today. The thing is that it changed the rules of the game in the middle of the game. So they had all these loans outstanding based on this certain amount of capital. And then all of a sudden, they didn't have the capital anymore to make loans. So they were called zombie banks. They couldn't loan because they no longer had capital. And that caused the credit freeze, and we never really have recovered from that on Main Street. Borrowing has never been what it was before 2007. So then we had the bailout. So you could argue that the whole bailout, I mean, you could see Bernanke and Paulson as really doing what they had to do to bail out our banks because of this sudden change in accounting rules that was imposed from abroad. You might even ask why we need the capital requirement imposed by an institution in Switzerland. And I would say you wouldn't. We could set up a whole different model of banking where we wouldn't need any of that. But those are the rules of the game right now, and that is what collapsed our system. So you wonder if you really want the Bank for International Settlements in control, whether or not they're doing what they think is the right thing. Anyway, they are in control. They're now setting the rules through their Financial Stability Board, which echoes a famous statement by one of the Rothschilds. Maybe it was Mayor Amschel Rothschild. Maybe it was Nathan Rothschild. Maybe nobody said it at all, but it's so famous that it totally characterizes their mindset. Let me issue and control a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws. So that's the whole goal here, is to privatize the creation of money and lend it to governments and to individuals. Our leaders have warned against that for centuries. James Madison said, "History records that the money changers have used every form of abuse, intrigue, deceit, and violent means possible to maintain their control over governments by controlling money and its issuance." John Adams said, "There are two ways to conquer and control a nation. One is by the sword, the other is by debt." And Napoleon said, "When a government is dependent upon bankers for money," which is what we have today, "they and not the leaders of the government control the situation, since the hand that gives is above the hand that takes. Money has no motherland." And that's what we have today, this huge banking cartel that has no motherland. "Financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is gain." So the IMF and the Bank for International Settlements now are indeed in charge of the whole system. In September of 2009, G20 countries met in Pittsburgh and authorized the IMF to issue $300 billion in SDRs, which are special drawing rights. So it's basically a global currency that everybody else will have to borrow. If indeed the intent, it was announced then in Pittsburgh, that this would give the dollar a chance to work out its problems. In other words, the idea was to not have the dollar be the reserve currency for the world anymore, allowing our currency to collapse like everybody else so we could get reduced to a third world country like everyone else. And then the SDR would replace the dollar as global reserve currency. That's not actually going to happen anytime soon, but that's the intent here, as a global currency and a global regulator, which is the Bank for International Settlements. This is a speech from President Jean-Claude Trichet 2 weeks ago. He called for global governance under the G20 and the Bank for International Settlements to avoid another financial crisis. And he suggested that the head of this unelected governing body, which those are my terms, of course, would be the Global Economy Meeting, a policy steering committee under the umbrella of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. And before that, in April of 2009, the G20 nations met in London, and they agreed to be regulated by the Financial Stability Board, which would be based in the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And all the countries on a handshake, I mean, this should have been a treaty at the very least, but our president, along with everybody else, shook hands and agreed that they would agree to these certain standards and codes set by the board, which is just a bunch of committees, kind of reminds you of communist Russia. You know, it's all kind of done by committee. Nothing democratic about this. And what these standards and codes cover is incredibly broad. I mean, it's things like economies and anything financial is covered by these standards and codes. So we've essentially given up our right to set our own standards and codes. I think really what we should do is require that that be passed as a treaty so that at least Congress is aware of what we just gave away. But that was all kind of secret and nobody knew what was going on. So if they succeed in doing what they seem to be doing, which is to require all countries to borrow from, to comply with a global regulator and to borrow from a global central bank, then we will be reduced to a third world country like everybody else. And you can see that in the EU right now, where all these nations, they can't issue euros. and they can't borrow from their own central bank. So that's Greece's problem. They can't issue their own currency, and they can't borrow from their own central bank. So now, just this week, the European Monetary Union, the European Central Bank, agreed to do quantitative easing, meaning they're going to print money and lend it to Greece. But they're not even a country. And here's this central bank that's not even part of your country that you have to borrow from, that's issuing the money that you borrow. Now, who are they going to lend it to? I mean, all these different European countries are going to be arguing with each other. The Germans aren't going to like what they're lending to Greece, and they're not going to like the interest rate. I mean, it's going to be very unworkable, it seems to me. At least our Fed, they do quantitative easing, but they don't tell anybody. So it really is fiat money in the sense that fiat is by order of the king, so they really are the king. And they say, we don't have to tell you, and we'll give it to whoever we feel needs it. But in the EU, they're going to have to be totally transparent because they don't actually have governing authority. So you can see that that's where we're tending anyway, is giving up the ability to issue our own currency. So the way to get out of this is somehow we have to get that power back, the power to create our own money. We can do it. The direct way would be to have Congress just issue the money, which they're allowed to do under the Constitution. They gave that power away to the Federal Reserve in 1913. But the trouble is that Congress is owned by the banks. I mean, we can talk about all kinds of things we'd like to have Congress to do, but they're just not going to do it. But where we do still have some control is on the state level. So that's where I think we need to start, is locally with publicly owned banks, state-owned banks. This actually happened for 100 years before the American Revolution. We did issue our own money. The colonists issued their own money. The 13 different colonies had their own different systems. And according to Benjamin Franklin, that's why the colonies were doing so well. I mean, we just had this wilderness that we turned into this very productive, abundant place, but different historians remarked on it. How could it that be that we turned it into a luxurious place without any money? We didn't have gold and silver. All we did was print these little receipts, and the governments would pay them for goods and services, and that was the basis of the money supply. Well, the best of those systems was in Pennsylvania. Some of them did just print and spend, and that was inflationary, like the northern colonies did that. But Benjamin Franklin's colony had the best of the models, and this is the one I think we should follow, where the colony owned its own bank. So instead of just spending, what they did was they printed a certain amount of money and they lent it to the farmers. Before that, nobody wanted to go to Pennsylvania because there was no money there. They didn't have gold and silver. They had to borrow from the British bankers, and the British bankers didn't even have banks there. So there just was no medium of exchange. So the government got this idea that they would lend to the farmers. They printed these little receipts called scrip and lent them at a better interest rate than they could get from the British. So let's say you would print $105. You would lend $100 to the farmers at 5% interest. Spend the other $5 on things that the government needed, roads and bridges and stuff. So now you have $105 out there in the system, which all comes back as principal and interest. You can then lend the same $100, spend the same $5 over and over, so you never have to inflate the system. It's totally mathematically sound and self-contained. And, of course, the interest goes back to the public, which means in that case, it replaced totally the need for taxes. They paid no taxes during the time the system was in place. Just the interest from these loans was enough to keep the government going. They had no government debt, no taxes, and prices remained stable. They did not inflate. So it was a great system until, of course, King George stepped in and said we couldn't do it anymore. And according to Benjamin Franklin and others, that was what we actually fought the revolution for. I mean, it was technically about a tea tax, but the problem was that the tea tax was owed in a currency we had no control over. We had to borrow British banknotes from the Bank of England and putting us in debt, just like a third world country today that has to borrow from the IMF. And so there was a sudden recession and depression, actually, and so the people rebelled and went back to printing their own money. That was considered an act of rebellion, and then that prompted the revolution. So we fought it to preserve our own money supply, but we lost the right, although we won the war for complicated reasons that I can't go into, but it's all in here if you want to buy my book. So today, there is one state that does this, North Dakota. It's also, I started writing about this like 2 years ago, and at that time, there were four states that were still solvent. You know, so I would say, well, look, it's one of four states. And they'd say, well, look, there's three other states. So what's their excuse? And then there were three states. And then there were two states. Today, there's only one state that actually is turning a surplus, and that is North Dakota. And it also has the lowest unemployment rate in the country. They make low-interest loans for students. They make 1% loans for startup farmers. They partner with the other banks, so the other banks actually like it. They don't consider it competitive. They sort of act as the Federal Reserve for their state. So basically, what they have done is escape the credit crisis. They escaped the Wall Street crisis by setting up their own credit system. And the reason they did that, they set it up in 1919 specifically because they were suffering the same sort of thing that we're suffering today. They were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers. And when they figured that out, that it was actually a ruse to get their farms, the banks were connected to the railroads, were connected to the granaries, and the granaries weren't taking their grain, even though it was good grain. And they realized that there was an actual intent to get their property. And when they realized that, they banded together, formed this nonpartisan league, as they called it, and managed to set up their own bank. So all states could do this, and I think they should do this. We could have our own separate publicly owned banking system, and then we can just forget Wall Street, set up a better mousetrap, and ignore the old one. In North Dakota, the bank is set up as, it's called North Dakota Doing Business as the Bank of North Dakota. So that means technically all of the assets of the state are the assets of the bank. So they have no capital problem. They've got their capital covered. And by law, all of the revenues of the state and of the local governments are deposited into this Bank of North Dakota. So they have a huge deposit base and a huge capital base. So they're very stable, a very good investment, actually. So among other advantages, for one thing, if you're a publicly owned bank, in North Dakota, they have a mission statement. And they say that our mission is to serve the state, to help the farmers, to develop energy, etc. So they have these certain missions that are for the public. The intent here is to serve the community. And so they can be held to that. So they can take the long-range view. You know, they can think in terms of a 10-year plan, whereas a private bank, by law, has to serve their shareholders, which means they have to do whatever will make the most money quarterly. Like, they're looking at their 3-month profits. And so even if they wanted to, they couldn't really invest in some long-range project that would be good for the community. They have to do the thing. It'll make more money for them to speculate. Then they have to speculate rather than make loans to small businesses, which might be risky because that's their business model. Well, a public entity has a different business model. It's designed to serve the public. So they can have in their mission statement that they will help small businesses, et cetera, all those things that we all know we desperately need. Plus, in North Dakota, they pay a real nice dividend every year back to the state. So they're actually a money-generating institution for the state. Instead of having the interest drawn out of the system, which is what causes the banking system to be a Ponzi scheme, in a state-owned system, the profits go back to the center. So that means that we, the people, pay less taxes because it just gives our state more money. So besides that, you don't have to worry about these bonuses, commissions, high-paid CEOs. They don't have toxic collateral. They don't have shareholders demanding short-term profits. So let's consider what we could do in California. California has a huge, like North Dakota, has a, or better than North Dakota. North Dakota has a population of less than Los Angeles, or like about a third of what Los Angeles has. Los Angeles itself could set up a bank, and Los Angeles is desperately, you know, they're desperate right now. So California has projected revenues of $89 billion. They have over $18 billion in deposits, which could be their startup deposit base. And then you can just see they could get, I think people would flood to the Bank of California because we're so burned out on the Wall Street banks and we're looking for, there's a movement afoot already to move your money back locally. And if you can see how productive this is going to be for the state, I think all the many people would want to put their money in the Bank of California. The treasurer manages an investment pool of $71 billion. Here we are, $26 billion in the red, and the treasurer has $71 billion that they can't touch. The reason they can't touch it is it's all earmarked for specific purposes. So, for instance, Governor Schwarzenegger tried to get money from the highway fund, and somebody took him to court, and the court said, no, 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 that was earmarked for highways. You have to use that money for highways. You can't use it for your budget. So here we have all this money. It's not being used for highways. I mean, it's sitting in these rainy day funds. Every local government has these huge rainy day funds, and the reason is they can't borrow without going to the taxpayers. If they don't plan the budget right, things just can stop until they can have time to go to the voters and get a bond issue. And that actually happened. I had to speak in Missouri before some government finance officers, and they were explaining why they have these huge rainy day funds. It's because a business can have a credit line, you know, so they don't worry about reserves. And a bank doesn't worry about reserves because they can borrow at 0.2% interest. But a government doesn't have that privilege. So they have to have these huge reserves that aren't being used. So it appears to me that a good accountant could figure out how to tap up. I use the term creative accounting, and somebody got all over my case because, you know, that suggests Enron. But the thing is that Wall Street bankers have these accountants that know how to set these things up so that they can tap into funds like that. So it seems to me you could take that $71 billion, and let's say you took 10% of it, and you invested that as capital in your bank. You're not going to spend it. It's only equity. So it's an equity investment in the Bank of California. It'll pay a dividend to the pension funds, et cetera, who have their money in the pool. And it could be some sort of revolving fund. So if they need their money out, somebody else in the $71 billion investment pool could, some other fund could be substituted. The treasurer could play market maker and say he'll guarantee the whole thing. So if you want your money out, the state will step in and fill the breach until they find another investor. I mean, there are ways. It seems to me that we have a huge potential that we could tap up to create our own bank. And if we had our own bank, we could do like other banks do. Instead of borrowing at 4.7%, which is the average of California debt right now, we could be borrowing at 0.2% like the banks do. Right now, states generally are paying 5% on their 20-year bonds. California and Illinois are rated A-, right along with Estonia, Libya, and just above Greece. So we're paying a huge amount of interest. And here are the banks that wouldn't even exist if we, the taxpayers, hadn't bailed them out, are paying 0.2%. So we could tap into those same privileges if we had a bank, if we became a bank. Illinois is paying 12% on late payments. So all those things, if we were a bank ourselves, borrowing from our own bank, we wouldn't have those problems. Banks are borrowing on their longer-term debt. They're paying 1.27% on six-month CDs. So it's still very cheap. Right now, there are five states that actually have bills pending for state-owned banks: Washington, Michigan, Illinois, Massachusetts, and Virginia. And then there are three other states that are talking about it. And then there are eight candidates of all different persuasions, three Democrats, two Republicans, two Greens, and one Independent, that are including it in their platforms. So I think California, too, should have such a bill, and that we could, in this way, solve our problems. So obviously there's much more to the story, and it would be in my book, Web of Debt, and my website is webofdebt.com.
You've just been listening to the second and final part of the speech given by Ellen Brown on May 16th, 2010, at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California. If you missed the first part of the speech last week, you can hear it at the understandingdeeppolitics.org website, or in a few weeks at the radioforall.net website. And that's the number 4, not spelled out, radioforall.net. Ellen Brown has a book out called The Web of Debt. If you want to get a copy, you can get it at her website, which is webofdebt.com. And now I want to tell you about an upcoming event. On Sunday, November 21st, the West Hartford Citizens for Peace and Justice presents an afternoon of reflection on Islam. There'll be readings of the Quran, and Andrew Schneider, the executive director of the Connecticut ACLU, will be speaking about Islamophobia and its relevance to our values, mutual security, and civil liberties. That's this Sunday, November 21st, from 3 to 6 p.m. at West Hartford Town Hall. For more information, you can call 860-216-6882. So that's 860-216-6882. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.